Hey, everybody, it's Sunny. I am just letting you know that you're listening on the free feed. We're bringing back the free feed episodes for a little bit anyway, because we have a new permanent guest host. We've got Mike Warren. He's back. He's back on the show. He's going to be with us all the time now. Vic, of course, has had his brain broken by too many CGI Marvel-type movies, and he's out. He's out. But Mike Warren's in, the Mulch King of Northern Virginia. Very exciting to have him on the show. This episode that you're listening to, where you're talking about Banshees of Inisherin from a couple weeks ago, I'll be posting episodes from a couple of weeks ago on this feed. We will have new episodes at the Patreon at subbeacon.com. We'll have new bonus episodes. We got a bonus episode on Lent. Lent. Mike and JVL got to explain Lent to me because I'm a heathen. But yeah, it's fun. We're back. We're back, baby. Operating full speed. So listen to this, enjoy it. And if you want the full experience on time, bonus episodes, et cetera, et cetera, make sure to go sign up at the Patreon. Once again, it's subbeacon.com. Subbeacon.com.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you.
When you didn't do anything to me,
I just don't like you no more. You liked me yesterday.
Why does he not want to be friends with you no more? What is he, 12?
What the hell's going on with you and me feckin' brother?
He's dull, Siobhan.
But he's always been dull.
The other night, 2 hours you spent talking to me about the things you found in your little donkey shite that day.
Well, it wasn't me little donkey shite, it was me pony shite, which shows how much you were listening.
Welcome back to the Sub Beacon. I'm Sunny Bunch, one of the several co-hosts that we have here. I'm one of the permanent guest hosts. JVL, another permanent guest host, is with us today, and our third permanent guest host, Mike Warren. Thank you for being back today, Mike. We're glad to have you as a regular guest.
So are we? MC so are type. We each other's guests? Like, is that how the guest host works? Like,
we're
welcome.
I've invited you. I've invited you into my home. You've invited me into your homes. We're all here together as guests for everybody. Mike, how are you doing? What's going on in your world?
Oh, you know, new baby stuff.
How's that working out for you?
It's great. You know, it helps that they're so cute. You know, like that really just.
What are you, 10 weeks in?
No, a month plus.
A month?
Oh. Yeah, almost 5 weeks. 5 weeks, basically.
So you're about to hit the peak, correct? Because the peak fussiness, which is the euphemism all the books use, is 6 weeks.
That's right. No. So it's like, it's like remembering that again, because again, after two kids, it's like I forgot. Like you just get that stuff out of your head and forget about it, especially with this long tail, 5 year tail. So, you know, it's fine. We're actually sleeping fine. It's a lot, and I'm older than I was with my first two kids, and that makes a huge difference too. You're just like, oh, like getting out of bed at 2 a.m. is just a different thing than it was when I was like 27.
Yeah, this is the unfairness of it, right? And people always say, like, you know, you have, when you have the resources, you don't have the energy. Yep. And when you have the energy, you don't have the resources. But it's more than just like financial resources. It really is like wisdom and the emotional resources to handle this stuff. And you just don't have them. I don't think anybody could ever fully be ready to have a kid, but you really aren't ready to have a kid at like age 22.
Correct.
Or age 19 or anything like
that. But
on the other hand, you do have the energy to like do
exactly.
It all,
I mean, so. Your frontal lobe is like not completely finished forming at that age. So, but you know, like then you think back, like, you know, my grandparents were like 19 and 20 years old when my mom was born, you know, stuff like it's
in County Ashernan.
No, but not too far off there. Not too fucking far off.
Don't neither of you do that again. Don't.
Oh, there's going to be a lot of Irish. Stop Irish it. Accent.
Irish. Yeah. No, it's funny. I take what both of you guys are saying, but it just reminds me of my opinion that the best way to have children is to be like rich and in the 18th century and just give them over to maids to send off to boarding schools as soon as you can. Like, that is...
Oh, that's such hot talk.
Think about how great that would have been to be like an oil magnate in the 1900s, or, you know, early 1900s, or like late 1800s. Just like, I got some kids, huh? Just gonna send them off to Exeter or whatever.
Especially if you don't have to die during childbirth.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. I wouldn't. That's not.
You just be the dad who doesn't have any risk of dying because of the childbirth. That'd be great.
Once again, just a better time. Better time.
The golden age. Yeah.
Santino, what you up to, buddy?
not a whole lot. I managed to. I found a new and humiliating way to injure myself yesterday. I was opening a wine bottle. And you know the like foil that they have on top of the wine bottle, it's called the capsule. Yeah. That's what that is. And you take it off with a foil cutter. You have a foil cutter, you like spin it around, you pop it off, and then you can get to the cork. I was taking off the foil, yesterday, for Valentine's Day. Pull back the curtain. Mm-hmm. We're taping on Wednesday, opening a bottle of wine for Valentine's Day, you know, classy, you know, $10 bottle of wine. And I'm trying to get the foil cap off, and it's like coming, it's all ragged. It's like, it's coming off in strips and strabs. And I foolishly moved my hand across. I got a paper cut. Ooh,
from the foil.
From my wine bottle, which was at first I was like, oh, that's just kind of annoying. And then the blood started pouring out, you know, as it tends to do.
I hope it was red wine.
From a hand cut. So I had to like stop doing what I was doing, go get a Band-Aid, put it on, come back, and finish opening my bottle.
Yeah, you haven't even opened the actual bottle. It wasn't like you had the excuse you had been drinking.
No, I didn't cut it on glass. You know, I didn't drop the bottle and have it shatter everywhere and then stick my hand in that. That would be a totally acceptable way to injure yourself, stupidly.
Absolutely.
But this was a whole new thing. So now the best part was, it wasn't even one finger. I managed to get paper cuts, foil cuts on two fingers at the same time. I don't know how I did this. Don't know how it happened.
You're such a romantic, Sonny. You really are.
But I suffered for Valentine's Day. We got it all together. I went out and I bought some fancy steaks at the Whole Foods. You Ooh. Know, got some fancy mushrooms. Ooh. Made up
some
a little
Bezos
mushroom
steaks.
Steak. But we did do instant mashed potatoes because I came to the opinion years ago, a decade ago, maybe longer, that the amount of time that it takes to make like mashed potatoes at home is absolutely not commensurate with the increase in taste or quality level that you get. I don't know. Do you guys have strong feelings on this? Do you ever mash potatoes?
Like
from actual potatoes?
I love mashed potatoes.
Do you peel your Yukon potatoes and then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got to do it. I mean, but the thing is it's only worth it for a major meal like Thanksgiving or Christmas or something like that because, as you point out, the time commitment to it. But like my wife does not like mashed potatoes, but not because she doesn't like the taste. It's because of what you just pointed out, of the time, of the like the effort. Like it doesn't, yeah. You know, but some really good creamy mashed potatoes with like tons of butter, tons of cream. Oh, it's totally worth it.
Believe it or not, Mike, you can actually put butter and sour cream and chives on instant mashed potatoes. And it tastes just as good. It tastes like 90% as good. The only difference really between instant mashed potatoes and mashed potatoes you make at home is the texture of it. The texture of the mashed potatoes is like it's a little lumpier. It's a little, you know, you've got a little more texture to it. Sometimes you'll get some peel in there and it'll give it that that extra little bit. But like in terms of taste, again, 90% as good for literally 1/50th of the time.
Are you sure it's all, I mean, for the amount of time. Does it say on the little packet potato or potato product? I mean, that's always sort of like my...
I don't care. Potato product and potato, as long as they taste the same, or again, 90% the same.
This is like ice cream that says frozen dairy dessert and not ice cream on it, because like they can't legally
I've gotten some of that before. Ugh. So when I was hardcore dieting.
Eating like eggs,
I went and got some of the like ice milk product or whatever it was that they, because they can't call it cream. Ugh. It's not ice cream. It's like
frozen dairy dessert.
It's some sort of, yeah, frozen dairy dessert, or whatever it's called.
That's what it's called.
And again, it tastes like 40% as good as regular ice cream. I didn't get much. I got one carton of it. I'd rather just eat nothing. I'd rather just. And the other problem with it is that it's really not that much healthier than regular ice cream. Like, you might as well just get the regular ice cream at that point.
Because it's going to satisfy you.
Because it'll at least taste good. Yeah. As opposed to the frozen dessert product, which is not as good.
JVL, what's happening?
I'm getting over the Super Bowl. It's the first time in my life that I've ever turned a Super Bowl off early. I'd say somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes left in the game, not of clock time, but of, like, you know, notional game time. I had been angry since the kickoff, and I got progressively angrier as the game went on. And there's no reason for this, right? When you're a teenage boy and sports matters to you a lot, you get angry at sports outcomes. I don't actually care. I don't know why it was making me angry, but it was, like, in a very real and visceral way. And
what was making you angry?
I could just feel just the looming disappointment of knowing that the Eagles were going to lose. That's all. Not because they were getting cheated or anything like that, but just I could just see the train coming down the tracks. And so I turned it off, and I felt much better as soon as I did.
Now, Mike, you're a Falcons fan, right?
Yeah, I knew that was coming up.
You've never experienced anything like this, right? In terms of the crushing disappointment of a defeat after being up at halftime by two scores or more. That's never happened to you,
right? Especially a situation where your Patriots fan, super fan neighbor comes over before the game, and you spend 10 minutes talking shit about the superior Falcons offense. Yeah, no, that's never happened to me. So I have a friend, a Philadelphia Eagles fan friend, former colleague who was at the Super Bowl. And
Bill?
No. This is a former CNN colleague. This is not somebody you would know. Was there at the game and texted me that night and the next morning, just these sad, like, I'm so sad, I can't get over it. And I was like, yeah, you'll get over it. And I, like, reminded him of 28-3. I said, I got over 28-3 eventually. And he's like, he immediately felt better. He was like, oh yeah, I can't get mad. I can't get mad about that. Like,
did you know that it was going south though in that Super Bowl?
We went in,
like that. That's my question. Like, did you, when you guys were up, did you think we did it? We beat Tom Brady, and then have the slow disbelief as it was, you know, the cascade was coming down the mountain, or did you have that omen, that feeling of death will be here the entire time? Because that's what I had.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're dissimilar, JVL, in our relationship with our hometown sports franchises. And that, I mean, there is, as with Philadelphia, with Atlanta, there is this kind of expectation of disappointment. And I would say my memory of going into halftime was, wow, we're up. What is going to go wrong in the second half that's going to, maybe not necessarily... We won't lose this game, but it's not going to be this nice going into the second half. And so when it was happening, it was that, again, like you said, like a train coming down. You're just like, here it comes. And frankly, like Patrick Mahomes, Tom Brady, there's a lot of, similarities in the way that, I mean, it was Mahomes. Like, he was incredible. So, like, how can you really be mad about anything else, just accept your disappointment if you're an Eagles fan. But I don't know.
Philly won a Super Bowl relatively recently, right? Like within the last 10 years?
They have won a Super Bowl, first ever in franchise history. It was five years ago. It was when they beat Brady.
That's right.
And it was an amazing game. The best Super Bowl I've ever seen, I think. But anyway,
this was pretty good.
What
this was a good Super Bowl. I agree.
just no, objectively the other one looking at the...
No, but the other one had like 8 lead changes or something. Like this one had a lead that was then overcome, that was then tied, but then a go-ahead. The Patriots-Eagles Super Bowl was back and forth. They just had lead changes over and over. I just don't understand why I care. That's what I emerged from this, think on this journey of self-discovery, asking myself, why? What do you care about this? And I can't explain it.
You said something in your newsletter about, you know, you were trying to come you know, you were in a dark place, I think was the phrase that you used. And I was kind of surprised by that because you had not been, you know, you hadn't been really like talking up the Eagles all year or anything. It was like, I was sure because that you'd been watching, but
I had the sense all year that this was an overachieving team, that the season was a gift, and that they were destined for disappointment.
What is the feeling in your household and Eagles Nation as a whole about Jalen Hurts? Is everybody very high on him? Is everyone like, well, this is okay because, you know, for the next 5 years or so, we've got a constant Super Bowl threat.
People are very high on Hurts. The educated Eagles fan, oxymoron, but I would say the Eagles fan that is the smart mark knows that they have 13 significant players who are either going to retire or hit free agency this season. So this was the final run for this team. Mm-hmm. And this team was not expected to be this good. And they have a lot of building blocks in place for the future. But the next season is certainly not a guarantee. I mean, the next season is basically a modified rebuilding year just because they have so many guys who are probably not going to be there. And so, you know, we'll see. There is good feeling also in coaching staff. They believe they're likely to lose both the offensive and defensive coordinator, but there is an exhalation on the idea of the head coach, Nick Sirianni, who, when he was hired, people thought was a very bad hire. And I would say people are basically feeling like, okay, at least the head coach is competent and is capable of putting together a team where there is buy-in from the players. And so there's that.
Are people in Philly happy for Andy Reid, who has now won his second Super Bowl, but not with the Eagles?
Are you fucking kidding me? Honestly, that's why it hurt so much. Like, if they had lost to the Rams or something, I'd have been like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, the Rams. It's losing to Andy Reid, the guy who quit on the organization for the last, like, 3 years of his, you know. Instead of just resigning because he, you know, clearly didn't have it anymore and needed a break and needed a change of scenery, he was like, I'm just going to stay here and wait till they push me out so I get paid. Fuck that guy.
So that's no.
The first time he's been accused of good clock management was.
I was going to say you lost to Andy Reid, and in a game where he outworked the clock, he had a player go down on the one. That's good coaching right there. Having not a player only, go down on the one.
You know what's funny is that the knock against him in Philly, even when he was beloved, like in the when things were going great for him in Philly. The two knocks on him were his clock management is atrocious and he never makes second half adjustments, right? Like the way he beat people was with scheme going into the game and with preparation. He's a great preparation coach. You know, the week before a game, like he really knows how to get his team together and have them planned so they're in a good position to win. But if things go south in the first half, like, don't expect a lot of comebacks because he's not a guy who could sit there and reorient the team at halftime. And that's how he beats the Eagles in the Super Bowl. Yeah. Great.
Wow.
Great.
He was a great guitarist for the Doobie Brothers, I thought. So,
anyway, it's fine. Do we want to talk about a movie? Can we talk briefly about how excited I am personally for the next several weeks of movies? Because we got
Ant-Man, text message.
We've got Cocaine Bear, which we're going to do 5 or 6 shows on. We've got the Super Mario Brothers movie. We've got the Michael Jordan signed by Sonny Vaccaro movie. And we've got there's one
Dungeons
other
and Dragons.
Good one coming out. Dungeons and Dragons, which I am so excited about.
Yeah, you're weirdly excited for that one, which I don't know. I don't know about.
Does it not look amazing? Chris Pine and Hugh Grant in a movie about Dungeons and Dragons? Sign me the fuck up.
See, I'm not a Dungeons and Dragons
nor am
guy.
I.
It's never been a thing for me. I don't really get it. I've told you my experience with playing Dungeons and Dragons, right? I must have told this story before on the show.
Tell it again, please.
When I was 9 or 10 or something, I was living in Florida at the time, so it was either 9 or 10. I went over to a friend's house who had for Christmas gotten a Dungeons and Dragons set. You know, this was like lots of people talking about Dungeons and Dragons. Mm. We were like, yeah, let's play this game. We hear great things. It sounds like a lot of fun. Let's set it up and play. And he starts taking out the stuff, and I was like, where's the board? Where's I don't
say, oh, there's
why are
no board?
What is
the board is your mind.
How do we move pieces?
I, the dungeon master, create the board in your imagination.
Around. And I literally didn't understand the game. So he's sitting there and he's like looking at the booklet, and we were like
create a character,
and I was just like, fuck it, let's go watch Goonies, because I was like, I don't want to have to deal with, and I don't understand any of this. None of this makes any sense to
you
me,
didn't
and it didn't make any sense to
you
him
You didn't
either.
Roll for your dexterity, roll for your
well,
wisdom
so, I mean, this
and constitution.
This is the problem. I feel like you need somebody to like usher you into the world of Dungeons and Dragons. You can't just have two people who have never played Dungeons and Dragons before
oh, right.
sit down and play
100%.
Dungeons and Dragons. That doesn't make any sense. So, like, instead of like going to an existing game where somebody could initiate us into the mysteries.
Yeah, it's like sex. You can't just like both be first timers at it, right? You need to be guided around the curves.
Work. That doesn't work. So instead, I like the first time I sat down to play it, I was like, "What the fuck is this shit?" And then just got out of there. I was like, "I'm never doing this again. That's it for me."
I do not know this for sure, but I feel reasonably confident that this movie is going to have zero to do with the actual game of Dungeons & Dragons, because that would limit its appeal. I think it's just going to be a sword and sorcery movie. That makes nods to the source.
It's like a battleship movie.
But way better, because it has Hugh Grant in it and Chris Pine, the best Chris.
Or way worse, because it doesn't have Rihanna shooting down
Riri's
aliens.
Not in it. That's that's a problem.
One of the two.
It's a problem for me, but we're looking forward to it.
Oh, it looks so good. We got good stuff. We got the amazing Mario Brothers movie, which
problematic
is a huge hit.
Mario Brothers movie.
Oh, why is it problematic?
Wait, how's it problematic?
Well, because the other Chris, Chris Pratt, he's not Italian. He's not doing an Italian accent. Are you unaware of this, Sonny?
Wouldn't it be more? No, well, I know people are complaining that it's not like the guy who voiced Mario.
He has a cameo in the movie.
But I feel like it would actually be more problematic for him to affect an Italian accent if he was
is
like
Mario being
Mia,
so I think whitewashed.
I got the spicy meatball. Princess the Peach.
I think what happened is a couple of things. So Chris Pratt was announced as the voice of Mario. So automatically that like people are sort of like on a knife's edge on the internet, right? Because Chris Pratt is bad, right? Chris Pratt is
there's
bad.
There's a vocal anti-Pratt contingent out there, and I've never understood it.
I don't get it.
Because he is an annoying screen presence who has gotten worse as time goes by and not better.
He's the best Chris.
This is wrong. You're wrong. He's Chris number one.
In my heart and yours.
That's no.
But regardless. But there is the anti-Pratt contingent. So they were ready for it. And what I think happened was they wanted to see what the movie would be like before they determined what they were going to be angry about Chris Pratt being Mario in this. So I think there was this, is he going to do an Italian accent? Is he not going to do an Italian accent? So once it was determined he was just going to use his regular Chris Pratt frat boy voice, then it became, you know, this is an affront to Italians.
But if he had been Italian accent,
if he had been, it's a me, Mario, would have been like cultural appropriate. It was just like...
That would have been, honestly, that would have been a million times better if he had done that. If he had been like, oh, Luigi, let's go fix the pipes. It would have been so much better, I feel like.
I feel like
that would be a much more entertaining thing.
Do a Bob Hoskins accent.
I think we're allowed to make fun of Italian accents.
I'm part Italian. Yes, you can.
I'm sure I've got some.
I'm part Italian and part Irish, so like let a rip as far as I'm concerned on these.
Speaking of being part Irish, this week we're talking about the Banshees of Inisherin, which is 100% Irish. Although there was a big piece in Slate by a critic who was like, you know, Martin McDonagh is not Irish enough for these Irish movies that he's making. He's fake Irish. Which was in terms of like dumb things that have happened in the discourse recently, that was number one or 1A in dumb discourse things. Banshees of Inisherin, nominated for Best Picture, has done not that much box office business, but some. It's on HBO Max now. If you haven't watched it, you should go watch it.
I went to a theater to see it, if you can believe it.
You saw it in a theater?
In a theater.
Is it in a theater now?
It was in a theater near me.
Which theater did you go to?
So I have never been to this theater. It is a one
Porno Dan's Movie Palace.
I've been there, Sonny. Let's not
playing the Banshees of Inisherin, but it just turned out it was
the
just
Banshees, the women. Banshees of Inisherin.
It was on the island. It was on the island of Lesbos, not the island of Ireland. I couldn't figure out what was going on.
Inisherin, I barely know her. So no,
Rocco Siffredi doing his Irish accent.
So, it's CMX. Are you familiar with CMX theaters, Sonny?
No, okay, I had
never heard of him. They are a Alamo Drafthouse wannabe, or sort of a, you know, they're sort of copying that format. Maybe not as sort of, you know, fascistic about the rules, but, you know, that's okay. But it's at Tyson's 2.
Is it okay?
It's not okay, but like it's tolerable. It's tolerable. Okay. It's tolerable. So this is at Tyson's 2, at Tyson's Galleria, which they've sort of revamped over the last like couple of years, I guess, since COVID. And so it's this, you know, they got the bar, the restaurant, they bring it to your table, although it's the table service is cut off 30 minutes before showtime. Or no, not cut off. You can't order after 30 minutes before showtime. So you have to go out.
Wait.
You have to go out and get your concessions if you want it 30 minutes before showtime.
Oh, that's dumb. That's dumb. That's the worst possible way to do a draft house type.
Yeah. Well, I didn't make the rules.
Because the whole point of the draft house is you never have to get up from your seat. They just come to you.
This is supposed to be a little more like have dinner and a movie here. Like dinner first.
Gotcha.
Than your movie.
Gotcha.
I went in the middle of an afternoon and I was the only person in my theater and it was fantastic.
Isn't that the best?
It's just the best. Mm-hmm. Anyway, continue.
What actual time was the show?
2 o'clock.
What was 2 o'clock
in the afternoon.
2 o'clock. So I swear near me in Dallas where I live, basically the only time they have showtimes before like 3 or 4 p.m. now are on Saturdays and Sundays. And Thursdays and Fridays, if there's a big movie coming out. So, like, the Ant-Man is coming out, and there are showtimes from, like, 3 o'clock on Thursday, and then, like, noon on Friday. So, whatever. But usually, like, the disappearance of the, like, noon or earlier screening at my draft house has been a real pain in the ass for me. Because it means that, like, I can't go until, like, 10 o'clock at night, because that's when the kids go to bed.
Yeah, the middle of the day, I mean, when I was at the Weekly Standard, like, that was like, JVL, you and I saw The Dark Knight Rises, like, at, like, 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
It was fantastic.
It's like playing hooky, you know?
We walked down to the East Street Cinema
No. You remember? We went to the IMAX at the Air and Space Museum. Do you remember this?
Yes.
It was great. But no, I agree with you, Sonny. It was weird. And I was also sort of like treated like royalty because this is a brand new place as far as I can tell. And again, nobody was at my movie. I don't think there were many other movies playing at the time. And so everyone's just like, hi, how are you? Good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
So let me ask, I'm curious about this the setup of this place. So you have to order your food before you go sit down?
I believe so. And then they will bring it to you.
And then they bring it to you. But like, if you want, like, if you want a soda refill or something, you have to get up from your chair.
Yes, there,
and you have to go out.
There
and
get is it no way of there's no not the cards like at the Alamo Drafthouse.
There's no cards. There's no like gotcha. Buzzer. So in Dallas, there we have our Drafthouse, which is, you know, with the card system. You yes. put up the card with the orders, whatever. But we also have Studio Movie Grill, and Studio Movie Grill is kind of interesting because it's like the Drafthouse thing, and they serve through the whole meal, but they have call buttons on their chair. So if you want the waiter to come, you press the call button and somebody comes over and like takes your order, which I don't like. I don't like that. It creates a level of interaction that I don't care for during the movie.
Well, do you have to speak to them or can you just hand them your order slip?
No, you like tell them what
it seems like. Optimal here is combining Alamo with that, where you hit the call button and then hand them the slip so you don't have to speak to them.
Yeah, that does.
You don't have to recognize them as people.
Well, that's my nightmare, having to treat the help like a you know, normal person.
Yes.
I want the help to send my kids off to the boring school and bring me my popcorn without interacting with them directly. Those are the two things I want.
Anyway, should we do a...
Sonny, how about a big boy review?
So The Banshees of Inisherin is directed by Martin McDonagh, who folks will probably remember best as the director of In Bruges, also made Seven Psychopaths and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. He is reteaming with Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson in this movie. Colin Farrell plays a not-quite-village idiot. Who is friends with the town's fiddler, is played by Brendan Gleeson, and the town's fiddler.
And their names are? God, say their names.
Brendan Gleeson's name is Colm.
Character's name. Mm-hmm. What is Colin Farrell's character's name?
Colin Farrell's name is Patrick?
Patrick Sullivan. Patrick Sullivan.
I don't know.
That's his name, is Patrick.
Padraig.
Right, but it's...
Padraig.
But it's Patrick Sullivan.
Padraig.
Oh, did I lose you guys? Uh-oh.
Oh, did we lose you guys?
We
may have lost him.
Give him a minute.
Let's see if he comes back. Let's give him 30 seconds here.
Sorry, guys.
And he's back. All right, Colm doesn't want to be friends with Patrick anymore, and he tells him this, and as the movie progresses, Colm tells him, tells Patrick that if he does not stop bothering him, Colm, that he's going to start cutting off his fingers and sending them to him.
Cutting off his own fingers.
No, not Patrick's fingers.
His own fingers, right. So this is all set up in the trailers, whatever. I find this movie... I kind of love this movie. It is both unsettling and sad and funny and like darkly funny, and it has like four of the best performances in the year. I have not mentioned yet. What's his name? Barry Keoghan, who plays the actual village idiot with this kind of really entertaining, twitchy awfulness, and Carrie Condon, who plays the sister of Padraig, who is fantastic in this. I've loved her ever since Rome. She was in
That's
Rome.
Right.
She was Augustus's older sister in Rome, and she everything she's ever been in, I've always liked her. But I think
she
this is
crust to quadrants in Rome.
She did early quadrant crusher. That whole show crushed every quadrant.
Gosh.
I like this movie a lot. It's very funny. It's very dark. There's something very sad about it. You know, obviously it's a movie about a friendship that kind of comes apart, but like, it's the way in which the friendship comes apart that is so interesting to me. It's not like these two have had a falling out. There's no Colm and
Are you rowing?
Yeah, right. Nobody can understand why it is that Colm doesn't want to be around them anymore. Patrick is lost. There's this really wonderful scene where, Patrick gets into a fight with a cop. Cop knocks him down. Colm picks him up, and this is after they have split up. This is their, you know, they are rowing, if you will. But Colm picks him up and drives him home on his cart and lets him off. And Patrick just kind of breaks down in the cart because, like, Colm doesn't hate Patrick. He doesn't. It's not as if they've had a falling out over a woman or a job or whatever. He just doesn't want to be around him anymore. And Patrick can't quite understand that and just loses it. And Colin Farrell is so good in this role. Just absolutely wonderful. He just sells the confused despair as well as that role possibly could sell it. And look, the movie is set during the Irish Civil War, which is kind of an interesting little background tidbit. I don't know enough about the Irish Civil War to discuss the, you know, particulars of whatever the metaphor that is working there. I don't know it well enough, but I will say that I wrote this in my review, you know, 4 months ago, 5 months ago when it came out, is that it's a very good movie. That kind of pulls apart the silliness of some of the national divorce talk that we hear in this country from time to time from particularly people on the right. There is no such thing as national divorce, like no hard feelings. We're just going to go our separate ways. Like that does not exist. What exists is civil war and self-mutilation and deformment because people are interconnected. We are communities, and you can't just be like, we're not going to do that anymore. That's not how it works. And I think that this movie is kind of a timely reminder of that to bring a little depth to it.
So I love
this movie a lot. I thought it was great.
I want to push back on something as a way of throwing this conversation to Mike, and I'm very, very excited that we have Mike here, especially for this movie. So my sense is that the entire movie is a metaphor for the Irish Civil War, that it's not like a writerly coincidence. The entire thing is about the Irish Civil War. And I wish I knew enough about it, but the commentary about, you know, I'm again the war. And then the cop who is happy to go over to help out, be a little extra muscle for some mass executions. And, you know, it's like, you know, Colm says to him, who are they executing? He's like, I think the IRAs are executing the other one, or maybe it's the other way around. I don't know. It was all easier to keep track of when we were all in the IRA. And just the idiotic nihilism of Civil War, and especially the Irish one, where they had just fought a war of independence, right? And then the same, you know, literally 4 years after the War of Independence, the same people split apart and fight this murderous. More Irishmen died during the Civil War than during the War of Independence, yes. Right? I mean, just sort of think of that for a moment, right? You go through all this bloodshed to cut free of the English, and then you kill more of each other than the English did. And I loved basically everything about it. It's because it's a metaphor. It works on that level. It works just as a story. It almost feels like a road movie, you know, in this, but even though we're sort of all in one place, it's beautiful. This is what movies that are made for a screen and not for a streaming service look like. And you can tell even when you're just watching it through a streaming service on your TV, I say the performances are great, and it manages to be, as you say, Sonny, touching and dark and sad and also laugh out loud funny. There is the scene in the confessional where so Colm goes to confession, and the priest he and the priest have this scene together. It's one of the funniest things I've seen. I emailed Father Anthony and Father Harrison, or texted Father Anthony and Father Harrison as soon as I'd finished watching just that scene. I was like, guys, you got to drop whatever you're doing. Drop whatever you're doing and watch this. And they both just laughed because the priest says to Colm as he's trying to understand why Colm and Patrick aren't friends anymore. He says, are you having impure thoughts about him? And Colm's like, what, are you having impure thoughts about men? And priest gets very upset. Well, how dare you say that? He says, well, you said that about me first. The priest throws him out of the confessional and says,
screaming vulgarities,
and you're not absolved from anything. Not until next week. And Calm says, well, if I die this week, then I'm pure fact, aren't I? And it's...
You are pure fact.
It's so funny. It's so... It's funny on, like, you know, four different levels. And I just thought it was an extraordinary movie.
Yep.
Extraordinary. And but anyway, so I wanted to throw this to you, Mike, and just ask about the Irish Civil War stuff, because you are, as somebody who is half... What an immense disappointment to both sides of your ancestors to have the Irish marrying the Italians. Yikes.
Oh, it's... Don't even get me started. Like, that's... It's on the grandparents, my maternal grandparents, and it's like it existed even, like, decades later, like, the divide.
Oh, I bet.
And they're from Philly, too. I mean, it's like the Irish... Anyway, so, okay, so I guess I'll start at the Civil War. Well, actually, let me back up a little bit. Like, both JVL and Sonny, you both said that it's, you know, it's sad, and maybe you said melancholic or funny, all these things. It is, which is, like, to say it's an Irish story, right? I mean, it is Irish. Yeah. And it is, the movie is so sort of imbued with Irishness that, I mean, you did have commentators saying it was playing too much into Irish stereotypes. My problem is, having been to Ireland, knowing Irish people, like, the problem is the stereotypes are, like, generally true. So
yes,
you know,
yes,
literally down to the running joke of the donkey coming into the house. I mean, when I went, I wrote about this, my visit to my cousins in Ireland in the Weekly Standard years ago, and literally we're sitting in their house in rural Ireland talking about the family tree and showing, you know, figuring out where we are connected, and the door of this house opens, and in walks the donkey. And my, like, third cousin once removed is like, get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here. And I'm like, so when it's happened in the movie, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's real. That's reality. I also loved, by the way.
Can I just say, yes. can I just say one thing that did jump out to me while I was watching it was that, like, this feels, the setting of this movie feels like it's, like, it could just as easily be, like, the early 1800s.
Yes.
As the 1900s, and, like,
or the early 2000s,
my understanding is that, like, it's actually not that. I mean, obviously people have cars and, you know, TVs and stuff, but, like, it's still not that different in parts of particularly the Irish countryside.
Well, I would say the Ireland of now, right? This was 100 years ago is when it took place. It would be demonstrably different just because everything is flat. Like, the world is all flatter, and that happened in Ireland. It happened in Ireland later. It happened in the late 80s and early 90s. But, I mean, that is, it lasted longer. I wouldn't say Ireland was ever a third world country, but it was like a second world country in the country for a really long time, for a place, you know, that in the West, in the European Union or whatever. So a couple of other quick thoughts. I mean, I have been to one of the islands where they filmed part of this movie. So there was the scene where Patrick and Barry Keoghan's character, his name's escaping me at the moment, the halfway.
Danny?
Was it Danny? Yeah. Where they're sitting, like, on, it looks sort of like these gray stones that are stacked on each other, and they're kind of looking out over the cliff. I know exactly where that is. I've been there. It is on Inisherin, which is kind of the stand-in where this fake Inisherin, I mean, the names sound similar, where this is supposed to be. And it really is, the movie captures the majesty of those landscapes. And it does look like that now. I mean, they filmed it there for a reason. It looks just like it probably did in 1923. In some parts, it looks like it did, like, BC, because that actual structure is older than Christ. So I loved that aspect of it. So on the Irish Civil War, without going too deep into what was going on, essentially what you had was the War of Independence. The conclusion of the War of Independence from the UK was essentially to make Ireland the Free State of Ireland, which would have given it a status not unlike, you know, Australia or New Zealand, a place in the Commonwealth, independent of its of the government in the UK, but still subservient. And so this was the divide, right? You had the Free Staters and the what became, you know, the IRA. sort of fighting it out. You had people saying, this is good enough. This is what we were fighting for. And the other half saying, no, this is not good enough. This is not, we're no more independent than we were beforehand. And so it's like you said, I mean, this is the kind of hopelessness and the self-mutilation that a civil war is. I mean, the metaphor is almost a little too heavy-handed, except for the fact that probably American audiences don't know enough about the Civil War to follow it. But also, it's Ireland. I kept thinking about this, you know, because the actual plot of this movie, sort of the big plot device of Colm cutting off his fingers, which is like horrifying and like grotesque, and fitting with the director's, you know, kind of love of the like funny and the grotesque, like mixing those two together. It's a little outrageous. Like if you step out of it for a second, if you step out of the story and think about it, you're like, it's so out of, the suspension of disbelief that you have to do to sort of like follow the story afterward. It's a little difficult, but I was thinking about how it has the quality of the way people in Ireland and maybe other places, but my experience in Ireland sort of tell stories about what happened. You know, I think about when I went to visit my cousins and then I met their cousins, who were younger and a little more aware of, like, their son was in the United States. So they sort of talked to us Americans a little more. They weren't as sort of backwoods. And we ended up spending a lot of time with them, and they were telling old stories about my cousins when they were young. And the stories were absolutely exaggerated, you know, about screaming at their mother when the first time they got drunk and walking through whatever, all this stuff. And I kept thinking, this story is like a perfect Irish story. The real story, if this were to be a real story, might be that, you know, he cut into his finger, but not cut his finger off. And that the story kind of grew into this kind of grotesque, maudlin, over the top story, because that's the way Irish people tell stories. And so, you know, in the way that, like, it wasn't magical realism, but sort of like exaggerated realism, I think just really captured the culture and the way that Ireland and Ireland sort of talks about itself, talks about its struggles over the centuries. It felt so, in a way that Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri was sort of a caricature of middle America. This felt so true, and it's probably because the writer director is much closer to it.
Well, can we talk a little bit about McDonough and his other movies? Because I don't know how you guys feel about In Bruges, but it's one of my favorite movies of the 2000s. I love that movie. It's great. And what he had made since then had frankly not been as good. I mean, Seven Psychopaths, I don't know if you guys have seen Seven Psychopaths.
I have not.
But Seven Psychopaths is interesting because it's his second feature film, and it immediately devolves into like weird meta navel gazing. It's about a screenwriter who's played by Colin Farrell, who has writer's block, and he's trying to come up with a screenplay about clever hitmen. And it's just like, okay, you're like, he's like already wrapped around his own axle there. And then Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, it's funny, I was one of the first critics to write a negative review of it. It got raves coming out of the festivals. You know, it was a huge Oscar favorite. And I watched it and I was just like, what are you people watching? This is a nonsense movie. It's not very good. It's overwrought. It doesn't work as a comment on whatever it's trying to comment on. The whole thing didn't work. But this is great. I mean, this is as Mike says, I think it helps that he is, you know, regardless of what Slate has to say, he is an Irishman. I mean, this is an Irish, it's a very Irish movie. It deals with a topic that is very near and dear to him. And Farrell and Gleason are both just magnificent in this. I mean, it's just it's amazing.
So here's what I admire so much about it is that the reason I think the movie just works at multiple levels. I suspect that this is a gigantic hit in Ireland, that Irish audiences love it.
I don't know.
Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I suspect this played very well in Ireland. So you can be a native Irish person or somebody who knows a lot about Ireland and appreciate it at the level of national epic in that way. And you can know nothing about it. You can just sort of see it as the story about these, you know, like a tale about these two friends and about a friendships in a small place work. And that works great. It works as a, you know, I think there's a big, one of the things that Pedrag keeps saying is over and over, he's like, but I'm nice, right? You know, and what people say to Calm when they say, why aren't you friends with Pedrag Namar? And it's like, you know, well, that's not nice. And the difference between, you know, is niceness overrated as a quality? And is nice different than good? As Stephen Sondheim asks in Into the Woods. And I just love that stuff. I think there's actually, I think you can mine that and have like long, interesting conversations yes. about it. And, you know, there's this scene where they're in the bar and one of the things that drives Pedrag nuts is that Calm has only cut him out of his life. He still hangs out with all these other idiots, right? So he is hanging out with this corrupt policeman who sexually abuses his son, who is himself an idiot. And Calm hasn't cut him out of his life, right? You know, only Pedrag. And, you know, Pedrag is sitting and talking to him and he says, and Calm has explained to him his rationale, and which is that, like, look, I'm going to die and I want to create something. You know, I'm a musician. And an artist, I want to create something beautiful that will last. Something that, you know, 200 years from now, people will remember. And Pedrag says, well, you know, my mother and father were nice, and I remember them. And this is a very, very large human question, right? About the creative impulse and about family and the nature of legacy and all that. And the movie has a lot to say about both. And in ways which are incredibly dexterous, I yes. think, and subtle, and not, oh, you know, hit you over the head. I just
that scene, JVL, was in a movie full of fantastic scenes. I thought was the best scene because it distilled it down right to like what this debate was about, and you know, and it spun out into interesting ways. Where does again? Is it Danny? Is that Barry Keoghan's character's name?
Danny.
Where is it where the breakdown between Pedrag and Danny is? It's when Danny realizes that Pedrag wasn't nice, right? Because Pedrag sent that poor music student home for the, which, by the way, that scene where they're talking about the bread truck was I was laughing out loud. But the you know, it's that moment where he describes what he's done, and Danny the halfwit says, "Well, that's not very nice. It's the last time that they have this friendship." Which of course is one of, you know, the ending of that, you know, is sort of a part of the breakdown of Pedrag's relationships. You know, it sort of had something to say about, what was, you know, what was important for Pedrag in his life. It was that he was a nice guy, that he was a nice person, that he had these relationships that he fostered and that's what he should be, focusing on. And it's not necessarily what Colm should be focusing on. I mean, it doesn't really, the movie doesn't quite take sides in that debate. It just presents it as these things are not easy. You know, there's not an easy answer to this. And it laid it out in such a beautiful way.
Colin Farrell is so good. Has he ever?
Fantastic.
I am sure Colin Farrell has given bad performances, but I can't remember any time I've ever seen him on screen and not thought that he was sensational. Even as Bullseye in the Daredevil movie,
he's doing something interesting.
He's the
in that
best
movie.
Thing like in the whole movie.
I mean, it's like it's funny. You know, he had that stretch in the early aughts where he was going to be kind of generic leading man, action star, right? Like he's in SWAT.
SWAT with Michelle Rodriguez, right?
He's in a bunch of stuff like that, and it didn't quite take. And I think we're all better off for that.
Yes.
Just in terms of, God, what was the Al Pacino movie that he's in? Is it The Recruit?
He's great. He's like the. It's a terrible movie. He's good but he's
at
great it. In it.
He's good in it, but it's a bad movie. Yeah. But it's but it was like generic leading man sort of stuff. Yeah. Like he's you know
he's great. What is we watched a streaming action movie that he has a tertiary part in? Not all that long ago, like a year and a half ago. I forget what it's about, but it's like one of these like there's a hitman who's gone rogue, and he's the boss of the hitman organization and.
Oh, the was that the one with John Malkovich and Ava? Was it?
Maybe it was Ava. Maybe that's what it was. But the point is, he's the best thing in it. He's the best thing in everything he's in. He's the best thing in Alexander, which is actually a reasonably interesting movie. He's the best thing in Miami Vice, which is a really good movie. And he's the best thing in The Gentlemen, which is a really great movie. He's just awesome.
And he plays idiots well. He plays, you know, action style. I mean, he's always doing something interesting. And in this movie, you know, so much of it is in his eyes and frankly, his eyebrows, you know, the way he moves them to express the internal anguish that he's feeling is terrific.
It's like confusion. It's confusion as much as anguish. That is the heart of this movie. Is it like it is confusing? Sometimes it is confusing to lose a friend. Sometimes we lose friends in ways that confuse us. And like, how do you handle that? How do you deal with it?
You just flip the switch and you never speak to him again, Sonny. It's that easy.
Some of us have better ways of handling this than others.
Yeah, but look how both of them end up, right? I mean, they both lose out of this. I mean, this instigated. So yes.
Right. It's a civil war. And
to add,
every side.
Yes. To add to the metaphor of this that I thought halfway through, I started paying closer attention to Carrie Condon, who plays Siobhan, the sister, Patrick's sister, because she's in the background for so much of this, and then all of a sudden the movie almost seems to be about her and not about this friendship, which I thought was very interesting. And the fact is that the end, spoiler alert, she essentially escapes, right? She goes to the mainland, she leaves, which is that's another element of the Irishness of this, which to really understand the Irish kind of mindset, it is a place that is, you know, literally insular. It is isolated. It is a little bit behind the times. And it's also a place where half of the people left and never came back. And that is as huge a part of the country's psyche as the division, you know, between North and South or between Catholic and Protestant or what was going on in the Civil War. It's this idea that the people and in some ways, the best people, that's certainly the way they feel, left. The bravest people, you know, the people who when they did leave, ended up more successful and richer than any of their, I mean, I've seen this in my own family. The story of my family's, the ones who went to America would come back to this tiny little Western Irish village that I've been to every year to visit. And the stories are that, you know, they had more money than anybody there knew what to do with. So one year they built a two-story house, which was unheard of at the time. Another time they brought a car. And when they came back the following year, the car was in the exact same place that they had left it when they brought it. And the reason was because the axles were too wide for the roads. I mean, so there's this kind of emptiness in Ireland of who's left, of who's gone. And the movie just captured that element of it as well with Siobhan leaving. I could talk about this movie for like 3 hours. Loved it.
Well, we're going to have to cut it off here.
Fine. I'll talk to myself about it for 2 more hours.
I'm so glad we found a movie we all loved.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I like it a lot. I'm glad it got nominated for Best Picture. I don't think it'll win, but
what about the either of them gets nominated for Best Actor?
Yes,
either Brendan Gleeson or Colin Farrell.
I think Gleeson and Farrell both got nominated, as did Condon. Yeah, and Keown might have as well. I think there were maybe
yes.
So are they both nominated for Best Leading Man?
No.
No, I think Gleeson and Keown are nominated for Supporting, and Farrell for Leading.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Because they are very much co-leads.
Yeah, they are co-leads. There's no...
I would...
Yeah, they must have made an agreement as they were pushing for the nominations to do one in either category instead of both for... Right, because if they'd both been nominated for Best Actor, then neither could have won.
Right.
Yeah, Farrell's nominated for Best Actor. And supporting actress is Condon, and supporting actor is Gleason and Keown. Yeah,
is this a, this is a Carter Burwell score as well. I think he was nominated.
Yeah, yeah,
it's great.
All right, that's all the time we're giving this episode. Make sure you tell friends we're on Patreon, subbeacon.com. You'll easily find us. Buy a t-shirt or something. I don't know. We'll see you guys next week.
So,
yes,
so I was the mystery reader in my second grader's classroom today. This is,
is this like the Masked Singer?
Sort of, yes. They have, it's just like a volunteer opportunity, and I did it by Zoom last year, and I did it in person today, and it was, you're not supposed to tell your kid, which I'm glad I remembered that. I was like almost going to tell him that I was coming in. I was like, wait, I think it's a mystery. And then you send the teacher three facts about yourself that maybe increasingly reveal who you are. And then they have to guess who they think it is. And then you show up and you read to them. And so I did that, and I walked in, and my son, Emilio, said, I knew it was you. And everyone like, they all decided that it was me. And then I read like 15 minutes of the first chapter of The Hobbit to them, and it was a lot of fun, you know. And they were, you know, it was funny to see them sort of like all they had kind of a general idea that this story existed, but like the first question I got was this a movie? And I was like, yes, it was like three movies. They were not that good, you know. And it was just interesting. They're at this age where they're like, they now like chapter books more than certainly more than like picture books and this sort of thing. So there was,
little kids.
They're big kids.
Exactly.
Now.
So there was a kind of like, I could tell they were like interested because it was such a thick book to them, but also like, you know, the very first beginning, there's no dialogue. And I think they were losing it a bit but they got into it. So it was fun. It was good.
Yeah. It definitely, that's the sort of book where I feel like it's kind of hard to keep them paying attention. You need like the Judy Blume books or whatever.
Yeah. Right? Or the, even the Beverly Cleary, yapping, you know? Yeah. Where everybody's talking
Beverly Cleary,
but the
R.L. Stein
Goosebumps. Sure. It's fine.
Are Goosebumps still a thing? Or
they are at the, like, they are at the library. I saw them.
100%.
Yeah.
That's good.
Love the Goosebumps.
I'm sure it's fine.